So who the heck is this guy? My name's Noah Mell. I'm currently the lead architect for a company called Combined Public Communications in Cold Spring, Kentucky. Formerly, I was a consultant at Hestexo, which is a small professional services team based in Vienna, Austria. They focus on Linux high availability, distributed storage, and open cloud. I signed up for this talk while working with them and decided to keep the slot. This talk encompasses OpenStack and Ceph, which is distributed storage, and open cloud. I personally am originally from Columbus. Currently, I'm based in Cincinnati. This is my first Linux Fest. To be honest, it's my first talk ever. I wanted to share my first real Linux experience because in 1999, Red Hat 6 showed up in a box at Micro Center, and I went and bought it and then failed miserably. As a lot of us did. It was fun. But stuck with it, and then doing the math, I realized it's been 14 years, which for me is half my lifetime. So this is the culmination of that. This is a QR code to take you to Hestexo. Most of this talk is distilled from Florian Haas's talk on a similar topic. He's the CEO of Hestexo. If you want to hear or meet someone who will just blow your mind, Florian's the guy. He can just go on and on and on. He'll go from DRBD to Linux kernel tunables to, you know, what's coming next with Ceph. It's pretty amazing. I work for my company internally now, and I can't comment on our internal systems. Suffice it to say that I probably implement some of these things, but I can't talk about it. So if you're interested in what I'm discussing, please go find Hestexo. Please go to the community, go to the website, go to the IRC, talk to these people. I know most of these guys personally. They are great. Also, there's an OpenStack convention in Hong Kong in November, which I would suggest highly. Which, you know, you go to your manager and say, I need to go to Hong Kong to see what this OpenStack thing's about. I would suggest it. All right, so first part, OpenStack. Has anyone in the room implemented OpenStack? I've got one hand in the back.
I have.
You have. Yeah. You have implemented OpenStack. How many people have touched an OpenStack system? Maybe use Rackspace Cloud, maybe use DreamHost Files. Okay. How many people have heard of OpenStack? Okay, great. That's the one I was worried about. All right. For those who are not clear or who are like, what's this guy talking about? OpenStack is your open source cloud. And it was originally started by NASA and Rackspace to fulfill an internal requirement, which was everybody used Amazon AWS, and they wanted it to be internal. And they thought, well, you know, this shouldn't be that hard. So they went and built OpenStack. Since then, there have been 7 major releases, soon to be 8. So we're on G, Grizzly. Havana's going to come out right before the convention in Hong Kong. What's important, one, is that it's open source, obviously. We're in a Linux community convention now, so open source matters to us. Two, it's Linux-based, which is important. Three, the leadership is open, and this is the part that really gets interesting. Although it was open source by NASA and Rackspace originally, they pretty much owned all the copyright on it, and they owned the direction of it, which doesn't really help a FOSS community, does it? You don't want to spend thousands of dollars and put in all these nodes and build your cloud and then have the rug pulled out from under you. Zen, VMware, I'm looking at you. You don't want that. Since then, they have created the OpenStack Foundation. They've gone out of their way to hand off the leadership, to hand off the direction to the entire community. And I've seen it firsthand. I've met the project team leaders of many of the projects. They're great people. They get elected. Anybody can go join the OpenStack Foundation, can get a vote. It's awesome. Make sure I get to all my notes. Oh, OpenStack is made up of quite a few different projects. The main project is Nova, which is the compute, which is how do I virtualize machines. But there are many ancillary projects, Keysung, Glance, Cinder, Neutron, Celiometer, et cetera, et cetera. Each of these projects is headed by a PTL. Each of these projects although have to work together sometimes, are kind of on their own. It's cool because they'll incubate new projects, like Neutron used to be a part of Nova and is now its own networking project. Cinder used to be part of Nova, now they realize they needed to be its own persistent block storage registry, so they went and did that. So, but we're here to talk about how Ceph works with OpenStack. Has anybody here implemented Ceph? I say Guy, we'll talk afterwards. And this
I messed around with it, but not.
Okay. Has anybody touched a Ceph system, other than obviously the same two gentlemen, but has anyone else heard of Ceph? Okay, we got a few hands, all right. So Ceph is the really cool part. I mean, not that OpenStack's not really interesting and really cool and free and you can build your own cloud and it's awesome. For me, Ceph is where it's at. Ceph is the distributive storage technology, it will be a disruptive storage technology. It is a distributed object store. Ceph is the result of a doctoral thesis by Sage Weil in California. He decided that block storage or distributed block storage was not the way to go. When you want massively scalable systems, it was going to be basically impossible. For those of us who have used iSCSI and SANS and DRBD, you've probably felt this pain. Ceph is built for massive scalability. We're talking tens of thousands of nodes. We're talking petabytes, exabytes, whatever. It just keeps going. It's designed to be run on commodity hardware, which is another important feature, right? You don't have to go to some storage vendor and buy a giant refrigerator and then buy a duplicate giant refrigerator and then buy your drives from them because they're certified. You can go get whatever hardware you want, throw whatever drives you want, generally the cheaper the better, which is opposite of what most storage technologies are built for. Ceph is mostly automated and it's self-healing. And we'll talk about more of these things a little more in depth. But Ceph is built on four main components: the native object store, and the block storage driver, the client REST gateway, and the file system. Now, only three of these apply to OpenStack. The fourth one, not so much. Let's talk about that real quick. So we've got the native object store. So at its core, Ceph is a massively scalable object storage system. The core of it is objects, not blocks, not files, but objects. Now, this probably gets a little hard to wrap your head around. You're like, okay, whoop-de-doo, I've used S3. Why do I care if there are objects? The biggest reason is scalability. The biggest reason is parallelism, which we'll get into a little bit more. This is sort of, the native object store is the brains of the operation, the core of the operation. You can interact with it, but it by itself is not particularly useful. Oh, by the way, I think the slides will be available, yes?
Yes.
The slides are available on the website?
It will be,
okay. On top of our native block storage, we can add some what the Ceph community calls apps. The block storage app is the first. It will allow you to allow you to present virtual block devices like any other disk, except that that disk is striped across objects across the store. Block storage with OpenStack, that part should be pretty obvious, right? You've got virtual machines, you got virtual machine images, you need block storage. The second app is the RESTful Gateway. Now, this is a C++ fast UGI app called Rados Gateway that provides a REST API for doing objects. And guess what? It's compatible with S3 and Swift. And we'll talk more about that. Since it's compatible with Swift, since Swift is an OpenStack project, you can imagine that it's useful. Now, there is a distributed file system, which actually Ceph was mostly invented and mostly written for this file system, which I guess is probably the most well-known feature of Ceph. It is a distributed, massively scalable file system that is strongly consistent and although really wonderful and, you know, beats the pants off of Lustre, etc., not really useful for OpenStack, so we're not really going to talk much about it. So we're going to go back to the native object store because this is the core. This is where everything lives. And we can talk about that a little bit. So Ceph is based on a distributed, autonomic, redundant native object store named Rados. Okay, autonomic meaning self-organizing. This is going to become key in a second. Rados stands for Reliable Autonomic Distributed Object Store. This actually comes directly from Sage's doctoral thesis. If you want to spend 10, 15 minutes and get like a little bit smarter, go find it online and read it. It will blow your mind. I can't even begin to admit that I understand all of it, but it's really cool. Rados is the brains of the operation. Rados is the layer that takes and distributes and deals with these billions of objects across these tens of thousands of servers. Rados automatically handles object replication for fault tolerance. Rados will automatically do balancing and self-healing, and that's what I have for that. Rados is in flat namespace. Okay, this is important. Instead of dealing with POSIX file systems where we have files and permissions and hierarchies that we have to keep track of, objects are really, really simple, right? They have a name, they have attributes, which are key value pairs, and they have a payload of any size, which is nice. Now, the any size is almost because once you get big enough, it will just turn one object into two. But in theory, you can have a 1 byte object or a 1 gig object. It doesn't matter. We don't have to keep track of it. The attributes are per app object, which are important because in POSIX, we can have permissions and other things that span many objects. And if we had to keep track of that over billions of objects and many, many servers, we'd have a problem. Now, the one nice thing is that when you deal with the objects and with Rados, there's really only three operations, get, put, and delete. So all the client layers deal with get, put, and delete of these objects with some attributes. So simplifies. Now, objects get assigned to placement groups, and placement groups are ordered lists of these object storage devices or object storage daemons, which is, depending on the version of the documentation you read, you see either name, where the contents are stored in redundant fashion. So we talked about Rados. Rados handles the redundant fashion. Placement groups help us define the redundant fashion. Why is it an ordered list? Oh, because it uses a primary copy of writes. So clients decide, I want to put said object into Rados. So clients go through their ordered list of OSDs and say, okay, you're the one I write to. Now, the nice part is that then the OSD is responsible for replicating the data, not the client. So client sends it to OSD. OSD takes it, replicates it, then returns to the client on success. Similar to DRBD Protocol C, right? We get TCP ACK, we get the write ACK, we get all the way to disk. Like, we know it's in two places before it's returned to the client and says, yes, I have this data. And that all happens automatically. The nice thing is that through placement groups, the number of replicas is totally configurable. You want two replicas, you want three replicas, you want four replicas, no problem. This is where things get really exciting. The placement of the object is completely algorithmic. There is no central lookup or distributed hash table. Central lookup, most of the time, is a metadata service. You use GFS, you use Lustre, you use these scalable file systems. You've got this one traffic cop that sits in the middle and decides where things are. First of all, it decides, and second of all, the clients have to ask it. It creates a scalability problem, it creates a point of failure problem, it's not so great. Distributed hash table is in there because that's what GlusterFS uses. And so nodes have to be aware of the entire distributed hash table. Now, Ceph does not do this. Every client in Ceph is aware of the entire cluster at all times. And it does this with what's called the crush map. The crush map is a pseudo-random algorithm, right? It's not completely random, it's pseudo-algorithm. It's pseudo-random. Now, we want it to be pseudo-random because we need the calculation to be fast. And we need there to not be any lookup, right? You can't go find it. It just has to like look at the object or look at the parameters of the object and the status of the cluster, and then it should just know. It should be able to calculate it and put it there, calculate it and get it there. The calculation is repeatable, right? So every client, based on the structure of the cluster at the given time, has to be able to come up with the same result every time, right? If I put an object with one client and I have six others and I need to grab it with those six others, all six others should be able to calculate the exact same hash and find the exact same placement of that object automatically. Now, it's topology aware. In other words, Ceph objects or Ceph object storage daemons keep track of the entire cluster membership from something called the monitor server. And the monitor server's job is just to tell the cluster what's going on. So the clients connect to the mons, the OSDs connect to the mons, and they say, okay, well, where is everything? You know, there are 60 OSDs and they're in these places. And they have whatever state they're in, because they could not be healthy. They could be, oh, I'm not healthy, but you know, maybe come back in a minute and check. So the crush map takes that into account. Because when you deploy tens of thousands of servers on commodity hardware, well, guess what? You're gonna have failures all the time. But instead of freaking out and saying, okay, we're gonna buy $10,000 hard drives, we're gonna say, no, actually that's okay. We're gonna have failure all the time, and we're just gonna be aware of it, and then we're just gonna deal with it automatically. We don't have to be aware of it, right? An OSD goes down, another OSD has the replica, the client can understand that and go find it. The other nice things about the crush map, replication can be defined. You do that through placement groups. Balancing and weighting, okay? So let's say you deploy a bunch of servers with 1 terabyte drives, and then you get some more money, and you're like, okay, I want to deploy a bunch of servers with 4 terabyte drives. Well, one does not equal four. So you can weight the 4 terabyte servers more so that the objects automatically evenly get distributed across your cluster so that you don't fill up your 1 terabyte drives first and then run into storage problems. Another interesting thing, by default, replicas cannot end up on the same host, right? So OSDs are services. They're like Linux services. They're processes that run on the host. And basically they're about, you know, you have one OSD per spinning hard drive. So the crush map takes into account the fact that you have many OSDs to a host, you have many hosts to a cluster. And by default, it says, I'm not gonna put a replica on the same host. But you can take that even further. You can say, I've got hosts, I've got rows, I've got racks, and I've got data centers. So if you've got two data centers with a high bandwidth, low latency link, you can tell the crush map, okay, I want 3 copies of the data. I want 2 in the first data center, 1 in the other. And of the 2 in the first data center, I actually want them in the same row of racks because I don't want the penalty of the network traffic, right? So you can define based on what your failure scenarios are, what the most efficient way of distributing your data is. If you want to know more about the internals of how all that works, how does an object go into a placement group, how do the placement groups map to OSDs, how do you define things like balancing and weighting, et cetera, Florian Haas has a great talk from LinuxConf AU 2013 with Tim Sorong from, oh, I'm going to say SUSE, and then I'm going to get it wrong. But you can jump on Google, find that talk. They go into really high detail. How does this stuff get calculated? Why is it repeatable? It's really cool stuff. I suggest you go take a look at it. So we've got billions of objects, and we've got tens of thousands of nodes, and we've got clients that are aware of the entire cluster all the time without talking to anybody, which means Ceph is built for big data. Actually, Ceph is built for gigantic data, okay? I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of nodes and petabytes and exabytes and scale that we couldn't even possibly imagine to achieve with block storage or with standard block scalable storage. So this is pretty exciting, right? This is Ceph. Ceph is really freaking awesome. Even by itself, we can say, okay, now we're all gonna go to the Ceph web page. We're all gonna jump on the IRC and go look up Ceph because this is gonna be huge. But how does this work with OpenStack, right? We wanna know, how do I fuel, how do I put a warp engine in my OpenStack implementation with Ceph? So let's talk about how you work with Ceph. Ceph has a bunch of client APIs. There are low-level and high-level APIs. The low-level APIs are mostly language and scripting libraries. We have C, C++, Python, Java, Ruby, PHP, Erlang, etc. At a higher level, we have the Ceph Apps, which I talked a little bit about before. We've got block storage with RBD, Rados block device. We have the client guest gateway, the client REST gateway with Rados gateway, and we have the distributed file system with CephFS, which doesn't really apply here. Now, this is key. Most of these, and by most of these, I mean RBD and Rados gateway are fully integrated with OpenStack. Now, this gets to be really interesting. You can deploy one data layer and run your entire cloud off of it seamlessly. Another important thing to note is that InkTank, which is the steward and commercial support and development arm of Ceph, who Sage Weil is the CEO of, they understand that OpenStack is key, and they spend a lot of time making sure that their features with their stack get into OpenStack and work correctly. It's really important to a lot of people, and they spend a bunch of time on it. All right, we're back to block storage. So we know that we can present block devices. Well, these block devices are then striped across objects. Well, that's awesome because you get parallelism like you would with maybe, you know, a RAID 10 or a RAID 5 set. Now, the other thing that's really awesome is that the Rados block device is thin provisioned, which means when you define a new block device, it creates a single object, which is very small, that includes the metadata about that image, and that's it. And only when you start writing to that block device do you then start creating and writing objects to the storage system. Now, you can use it like any other block device, right? You pop in a hard drive, shows up in dev. This is very similar. You can partition it, you can format it, you can present it to virtual machines, which is what's important to us. Okay, one other thing you need to think about is that because the storage layer is decoupled from a physical host, we can do important things like virtual machine migration. That data lives on a layer, and the client that's talking to it, it understands that I go talk to the Ceph cluster and I get my data. So if you want to move one machine to another host, it's not a problem because it's all talking to the same layer. Now the other important fact is it's not like iSCSI, right? Because iSCSI, you've got a target on a physical host, so that if that host fails, then you have to keep track, okay, that physical host fails, maybe I'm using DRBD and pacemaker and I fail over, but then OpenStack has to be like, well, or you do it with a VIP and the VIP goes down for a while and your machine crashes, which is awesome. Now, in terms of Ceph, when failure happens, client's unaware, right? If an OSD goes down, the client knows where to get the other object from the replica, so pretty much seamless. Now, there are a couple ways, there's some more features we want to talk about. All right, it supports cheap read-only redirect snapshots. Now, for OpenStack, I can imagine that you would want to maybe build golden master images. You would maybe want to keep track of configuration changes. Because the block device is not one contiguous device, but in fact an amalgamation of a bunch of objects, it's pretty trivial to keep track of those objects and to understand at what point where was the data at. One thing to know that's important is that snapshots are read-only, which could be a problem, but we've got cloning. And with cloning, we can take those snapshots and we can clone them and make them masters for other RBD images which we could write to. And this is something you can use in OpenStack all the time. For those who know OpenStack, there's GLAMS, which is your image registry. It's very similar to AWS also. When you use ephemeral images for your disks, for your machines, you want to quickly be able to boot up said machine from your ephemeral disk, tear down your machine, and forget that disk, right? That's what GLAMS does. And GLAMS can do that with cloning and RBD. Now, RBD specifically is implemented in two flavors. And this is really sort of depending on your hypervisor. There is a kernel level block layer device that has been upstream since 2.6.3.7. This is mostly used for when your hypervisor is Xen in OpenStack. Basically, you map an RBD volume to your kernel, and it shows up in dev, and then it's accessible. Most people, yeah. But most people are using libvirt KVM, so they have a QEMU RBD user space driver. This is extremely interesting because it's built right into QEMU. And it's not host specific, right? You don't have to mount it on the host, then mount it from KVM to a physical device. You can define like file or fizz, PHYS. You can define a set backing device. And this is great because you can just drop your machines in, you can move them host to host. You're not keeping track of a physical virtual host. For physical virtual host doesn't have to keep track of any of this, which is much less overhead. The other thing to note is that given the way kernel works and given the way the SEP team works, I pretty much can tell you that the QEMU RBD driver tends to be a little more current than the kernel driver. If RBD gains features like what they call version 2 snapshotting, et cetera, these things end up getting implemented in the QEMU driver first before they end up in the kernel. And that's just sort of generally how it's going. So if you're deploying OpenStack, most people are doing libvirt KVM, this is probably the way you want to do it. So let's talk about Glance. Glance, as an OpenStack project which deals with the images of block devices, is completely integrated with RBD. And the setup's actually pretty simple. You define your CephX user and secret, which is your authentication to the pool, and you tell where the pool is, and then off you go. And then when you work with Glance, you are completely abstracted from Ceph. So if you're using Nova to boot from a Glance volume, if you are using a Glance CLI, like you want to go download an image from the web and push it into your cluster, Glance takes care of taking that image, putting it in Ceph, and registering it with its UUID. Totally seamless. It's awesome. The other thing that's important about block storage is RBD is fully integrated with Cinder. And Cinder is the persistent block storage, right? So Glance is the ephemeral images. Cinder is the registry of permanent persistent block storage in OpenStack. And therefore, it's fully integrated with Nova for boot from volume. So you can boot your virtual machines from your Ceph cluster directly. And this is pretty awesome, because now we're saying that one unified data layer can provide your images, can provide your persistent block storage, and et cetera, et cetera. Because we can really scale this way, right? I want to add more block storage for my VMs, I expand my Ceph cluster. I want to add more block storage for my images, I expand my Ceph cluster. And the way you expand your Ceph cluster is you add more OSDs. You just rack servers, you put them in the cluster, it's pretty simple. If you want details about that specifically, you need help, or you're interested in it, please go find Estexo, please jump on the Ceph IRC. It's a really great community, they will help you with a lot of things. This is how we get to Ceph through Nova and Cinder, right? Cinder API is the registry of block devices. So when you tell Nova, okay, I want to boot this VM from this Ceph RBD, basically Nova goes to Cinder API and goes, okay, where is this UUID for this block storage device? And Cinder returns the Ceph RBD, and actually Nova goes directly to Ceph to get it. And if that's not enough, we've got RESTful object storage. So for those who are familiar, there is an OpenStack project which provides RESTful object storage. It's called Swift. The really interesting thing is that we can use Ceph with Rados Gateway as a drop-in for Swift. Now, Ceph provides RESTful HTTP access to the object store with something called Rados Gateway. Rados Gateway is a fast CGI application, and it uses the libRados PPC++ API. What's interesting about this is Rados Gateway runs on any web server that supports fast CGI, although the Canonical deployment is with Apache and Logfast CGI. And I'd like to note that even then, you may want to go talk to the Ceph community and check, because I think they have a fork of Logfast CGI with things that help you with using Rados Gateway. Now, that may have been upstream by now, so Don't quote me on that. Now, theoretically, you could use any fast CGI server to do this, which includes IIS, but I wouldn't. We're in a Linux convention. I don't think anyone here is going to do that. Now, instead of going and implementing their own REST API so we can all have one more nice API to learn, instead they went and they said, okay, well, we're just going to implement S3 in Swift. It's a drop-in replacement. You have a client that talks to S3. You have an app that talks to S3. You can point it to your internal Ceph cluster with Rados Gateway and start using it. So if you want your own internal S3, bam. Also, it does OpenStack Swift. And in fact, those two APIs are interchangeable. So you can create a bucket in S3, push an object, then point a Swift client to that as a container and grab the same object. So it actually provides sort of a cross-compatibility layer. I don't think Swift behaves that dissimilar to this. This is important. Rails Gateway supports native load balancing and scale-out. Well, why is that? Well, first, HTTP is the stateless protocol. Awesome. Two, Rails Gateway as an application doesn't store anything in Rails Gateway, right? It takes API calls, and then it goes to the object store to get them. It doesn't need to store anything. So you can scale this out in any way that you would normally scale out any of a web application. You can have round robin DNS. You can have TCP or HTTP reverse load balancers. You can decide to shard your access, internal, external, or in terms of the kind of bandwidth that you want to use. It's really awesome. One other thing about Rados Gateway is it now supports Keystone authentication. So the authentication that you use for the rest of your OpenStack cloud is now available to you to get to your Rados Gateway. And here is a nice little graphic of how we do this. HTTP request hits Rados Gateway fast CGI application, and then it as a client of the object store goes to the object store layer and gets and puts the information. So, what's newer? Oh, I have a question.
Actually, stepping back to the HTTP gateways, do you generally load balance those? I mean, Rados takes care of a large amount of redundancy and failover for you, so do you have multiple HTTP gateways or load balance? What are the strategies there to make sure that's highly available?
Implementation strategies are generally more than one Rados gateway for fault tolerance and performance, right? You would deploy a number of Apache servers running in Rados Gateway as individual hosts, and then you would load balance across them. You don't have to. You can have one. If you have one, of course, we have SPOF. We have single point of failure, so probably not a good idea if you're running a cloud internally or externally. But basically, it's one to many, right? It's one plus. You can go as many as you want. And you can load balance anyway. So it pretty much is like any other web application that you can load balance, which is nice. So actually, I'm not quite ready to go to what's newer. What I want to talk about is, so what we've seen is that we've got one massively scalable object store that presents all of our block storage for our cloud and all of our RESTful client gateway for our cloud, presents a number of client libraries for you to tap into with your own applications. And you can even expand it and say, well, if I can do a kernel RBD, then I can present iSCSI targets by making a block device with RBD and then using TGT to provide an initiator for other clients. So your choices are endless. It's built on commodity hardware, and then you are expanding and scaling your data layer, your storage layer, for your entire environment seamlessly, which we think is pretty cool. So what's newer? We've got incremental snapshots. Incremental snapshots were added. This lets you define or explain the difference between two snapshots, right? You take a snapshot at time one and a snapshot at time two, but when you want to back it up, you don't want to back up the whole thing at time two. You want to back up snapshot one, and then you want to back up the change between one and two. So this has been added. This is not that dissimilar to ZFS send and receive in sort of in use for those who are familiar. I think most people are using this in sort of asynchronous data centers for redundancy or sort of disaster recovery. We've got integration with Cinder Backup. So Cinder backup is part of the Cinder project, allows us to back up the whatever we want to an RBV volume in our cluster. We've got improved RHEL support. Interesting thing to note, Ceph provides packages for pretty much every major distro. So they package and keep up to date their own repos. They are generally a little newer than like if you're using the Ubuntu Cloud Archive. I would probably go to Ceph to get the Ceph packages. I want to thank Sage Weil. I want to thank InkTank, Florian Haas, and Hestexo, and the OpenStack Foundation. And I am ready for questions. And we have no questions.
We're still trying to digest.
I was about to say, I just blew your mind with Ceph. No questions? I have a question.
Where does this stand with the OpenStack project? Because you've currently got, is it going to always be an adjunct to the project, or do you think it will actually get pulled in as a separate project?
It being Ceph?
Yeah.
The question is, how does Ceph integrate with the OpenStack project? Is it an OpenStack project? Is it going to be integrated with an OpenStack project? I can't comment for InkTank, but I would probably say that Ceph exists for more things than OpenStack. And InkTank exists to make sure Ceph does the things it needs to do, and OpenStack is one of those things. So I think it's more of an integration to make sure that the teams who deal with the OpenStack projects, that everything works with Ceph, and as Ceph and OpenStack grow, that it's a symbiotic relationship. But I have no official comment there, because I don't speak for anyone other than myself. All right, the question is, what is the minimum amount of hardware? The amount of hardware required to do a proof of concept of Ceph, 3 boxes. That's it, 3 boxes. To do a Ceph and OpenStack, probably 4 boxes, maybe 5. If you wanted to do OpenStack and HA, you're looking at 8 to 10, right? If you want a full internal proof of concept, I think you're at 8 to 10. But Ceph by itself only requires 3 boxes, which is really awesome. The reason for the 3 is that the monitoring servers have to be in odd numbers. And it has to do with the way the quorum works. And you don't want to deploy with 1, obviously. And deploying with 1 doesn't really help you because you have no network parallel file system at that point. You have 1 box. It could be a nice SCSI target. So actually, 3 works really well, amazingly. You can, go grab a Super Micro chassis and pump it full of 4 terabyte drives, throw in some SSDs for caching, and off you're going. You probably want to look at maybe 10 gig or 40 gig for a replication network and an access network, depending on what you're doing. At least, definitely for replication, right? So, like, if you have a bunch of 1 gigabit clients connecting to it, that's fine. But you want your replication backbone to be faster than that. Question.
You mentioned in one of your early slides that it's more consistent than some of the other mass storage options, like Gluster or something.
Well, I wouldn't say it's more consistent than Gluster. What it is more, the crush map allows each client to be aware of the entire cluster just by the state of the cluster. So the difference between Gluster and GlusterFS and this is that with Gluster, all of these server nodes and possibly the clients have to be aware of the entire hash table all the time. In this case, that's not the case. The object storage daemons keep track of all the objects. The clients inherently know where everything is. It's like omnisciently they know. So omnisciently, it's math. But because of that, you can be really, really, really you could be really paranoid with your data, right? You could have 4 replicas. And you're never concerned with failure because like a client will know where every 4 of those replicas are at all times.
Is it consistent enough to like run a relational database or
the question is it consistent enough to run an RDBMS on it? Okay. So And by that, you mean like MySQL and Postgres, right?
Whatever,
right.
I know that's a problem with Gluster.
Okay, so we can talk about Gluster specifics, but basically, when you present an RBD device, it's entirely consistent, 100% of the time. And that's one of the biggest features of it, which is why we can put virtual machines on it. Because the RBD device is not, I mean, with Gluster, you're actually moving files around and making sure files are replicated. So like if you use Gluster, maybe with NFS or with the client, you're actually like storing your backing files for MySQL on Gluster, and then Gluster takes care of replicating those files. In this manner, what we would be doing is presenting a block device that is 100% consistent, 100% of the time. So you can use it for an RDBMS. But you have to be careful, specifically with transactional databases with network latency. So that becomes sort of an architectural choice. It also becomes a choice of how you design your OSDs. And you know, you can catch me later and we can chat about that if you want. But it's basically good for everything. More questions.
So if it knows about every node in the cluster, if every client knows, then is it multicast or unicast? Well, it'd have to be some sort of multicast to say, hey, I'm alive.
Yeah, so I didn't explain that part so much. Basically, there are three services or a number of services called mons. And the mons job, as opposed to the OSD, the mons don't store data, the mons keep track of the state of the cluster. So when you, and actually if you ever build an OSD and put it together, the config file needs like four values. And one of them is where's the mon, and or where are the mons, and that's it, right? The OSDs talk to the mons elect a, they elect through quorum the monitor that's active, and the OSDs tell the mons what's going on. If an OSD disappears, the mon chops the OSD off as part of the cluster, and then all the clients get told that, and then they react accordingly. Question?
Yeah, so you were talking about growing these things to 10,000 nodes and all this other stuff. What's the state of automatically pulling this stuff? I know there's some work to push this stuff out through Puppet, but I don't know if you can speak to other config management systems or other strategies.
Yeah, so Ceph itself is super easy to deploy. And I know that there are Puppet stuff. There are Puppet, what's the Puppet term? It's not cookbook. I just want to say chef all the time. What?
Module.
Yeah, I believe there are Puppet modules. I've personally deployed it with Chef with really good results. I'm more of a chef head, so I don't like to comment on Puppet so much. Other than that, I try not to use it. Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be difficult. If you've ever written a cookbook or a Puppet module, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to add the repository, I'm going to install the package, I'm going to change this one config file, and then I'm going to restart the OSD or start the OSD. I mean, it's like four atomic operations that you have to keep track of. It's not difficult. I can put you in touch with some people who probably are doing it currently or would know the exact answer to your question, or if you have a specific environmental question. Any other questions? More in the back.
Has there been any work done on a Windows block device?
I have no idea. My answer is why.
You might want to use the storage, but not virtualize the key.
Well, I mean, at that level, I would just say you just virtualize Windows on top of RBD devices, and then there you go. You've got Windows with RBD devices. Because you put it in OpenStack or you put it in Xen. I'm pretty sure I can tell you that there is some VMware stuff coming, which is probably, I would say, more useful, right? I think I would go check with Ceph, say, VMware, and see what they say. I'd be interested. I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know if they're trying to put a Windows block device in. For me, I'd just be like, why does anyone use Windows? But that's a personal opinion which may not belong. Yes?
Currently, we're deploying our VMs on NFS in the form of imaged files.
Like QCAL2?
Yep.
Okay.
And we've got a complicated method of making snapshots to allow us to roll forward, roll back, roll partially forward, grab data, roll back again. If we go to use the block devices, we're not going to get that type of granularity, or we're going to have to do it in a different way. Would using the file system directly allow us to substitute a Ceph cluster for NFS?
So the question is, when deployed with QCAL images over NFS, could you use a Ceph file system to help you gain the same sort of feature set that you have with snapshots with QCAL 2?
Correct.
Are you using LVM snapshots too?
No, we're doing it independently.
Just with QCAL 2 snapshots? Okay. Well, I would say that CephFS is not a good way to do that. I think what is missing here is that OpenStack as a project has some of these things like snapshots and incrementals and things built into OpenStack and thereby built into Ceph. So are you deployed with OpenStack?
No, we're Proxmox.
Proxmox, okay, yeah. So basically what I would say is that your best choice is to use OpenStack and get those features that integrate at a core level. That being said, using RBD, you can get all those things, right? Because you can take snapshots, you can take incremental snapshots, you can clone. So you could take a snapshot, clone it, mount it somewhere else, and back it up. You could do an incremental snapshot, mount that. Well, you couldn't mount that because it's just the change. But you could take an incremental snapshot, mount that, and back it up. So it would require something that allows you to plug in and out RBD volumes at will, which you could actually do with the Linux kernel driver, right? So you could say, you could script something that interacts with the Ceph CLI tools that take snapshots. Then you can have a machine that dynamically or scriptedly mounts these RBD images, does the backup, and then unmounts them, and then you can delete the snapshot, or you just keep the snapshot because there's like no overhead.
Would the file system allow us to use QCAL images directly if we weren't? We weren't worried about the snapshotting features and our other options?
I just wouldn't. I mean, basically, the Ceph file system is not made to be that fast and that consistent with something that large, right? Like, it's not great at putting up a 1 terabyte QCAL 2 image and expecting it to be completely consistent across the cluster at all times. And then I would also say that your disk performance with QCAL 2 is probably not so great anyways, and you probably realize better access and write speeds if you went to RBD directly. Because there's a lot of overhead in QCAL 2.
Is there a way to copy out the image after?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, the question is, how can I convert from QCAL 2 to RBD? And actually, there is a wonderful libvirt-based tool that allows you to move data around in multiple image formats, and it supports QCAL 2, it supports RBD, and it now has a progress indicator. Yes. For those of us who use PV-S, those days are over. Actually, you couldn't really use it. It's QEMU-image, I think. QEMU-IMG is the utility, and it allows you to convert QCAL, VDI, VDMK, RAW. The list goes on. You've got all sorts of options. You can use it to start to look at your snapshots and maybe how it's doing its snapshots. You can just say QEMU image convert QCAL 2 RBD go with a modern build. So I would look into what build has RBD built in, what build has progress indicator, and you can just run one thing and move to RBD, which is awesome. Or you could move it to RAW and do DD, like as if you would from QCAL 2 to like an LVM. So yes, there's a nice user space tool for that. Any other questions? That's you telling me I have 10 minutes, or that's you have a, oh, I have 5 minutes. Okay, more questions in the back.
Does Ceph have any kind of concept of tiered storage? Like, you know, I got a set of hard disks for cold storage, and I want some SSDs to get used for like a caching layer, or stuff.
The question is, does Ceph have tiered storage? The answer is no. The reason is that you shouldn't need it. And the reason that is because your hard disk should be as slow as cheap as possible. And if you want performance, then you deploy your OSDs with SSD caching. And you can do that in a number of ways. Ceph allows you to have a journaling device for your caching, or you can use something like FlashCache or Bcache, so you get two-way caching. I have a lot of success with FlashCache. I like it very much. So you can set up FlashCache with your spinning drive, point your OSD at that, then all of a sudden you've got really fast SSD with 4 terabytes of data, and it costs you $300 or whatever.
Well, I was looking at the Ceph roadmap during your talk, and you have some Turing models on schedule for February 2014, so.
Well, yeah, okay, that's wonderful. So this guy did what I asked him to, right? He went to the website, went to the community. I mean, I would tell you that you can deploy your OSDs with SSD caching, which I find it to be moot, which would be the way I'd suggest you do it. And then that way your storage across your entire environment has somewhat heterogeneous access speed. And it's cheap, right? Facebook wrote flash cache for a reason. They're like, we don't want to go buy this stuff from EMC. Oh, I got a few laughs. Are we out of questions? So you're all gonna go download Ceph and install it and play with it? Yeah? All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.